Salsky Southern Oral History Program, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is the third session in my interview with Harry and Sarah Kittner. We're in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It's February 22nd, 1999, and it's good to be back. And I think we're going to start with, I wanted to ask more questions about your children. We kind of just got to that part of your lives when I left last time. Sarah, do you want to start? How many children did you have?
We have four children. Our oldest is Ben. Ben is 45 years old now. Betty.
He was born in 1952.
Right.
Four?
53.
53.
We were married in 52.
Yeah. don't put that on record, please. And Betty is next. And Betty was born in 1956? Yeah. Then Bert was really Berta Gale. We call her Bert. And she was born in 58. And then our youngest is Sam, and he was born... 5 years.
1963.
They're all Tar Heel fans and all graduated from UNC.
And all but one is still here in North Carolina, right?
Correct. Sam is in the Washington, D.C. area.
And he's a photographer.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the children is in medicine.
She works with Glaxo Welcome. Yeah, and she has a degree in public health education from UNC, and she became a physician's assistant, and she got a certification from Wake Forest University.
And is that Betty?
No, that's Bert.
That's Bert, okay. Mm-hmm. And where's Betty?
And Betty is a teaches at Guilford Technical Community College in Greensboro.
And your son's in, other son's in Raleigh.
Yes, and has his own public relations firm, Technology Communications.
And looking back at their childhoods, I mean, are there especially memorable times to you? Were y'all a close family?
Very close family. Yes.
We still are.
Yes, we still are. That's one of the things we pride ourselves on. The children are constantly in touch with each other and with us, which makes us feel very good. And we now have four grandchildren, and the fifth is on the way.
Mm-hmm. I think it's harder sometimes for the children to be close to each other into adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
Especially nice.
Mm-hmm.
They would be.
It is nice. And being a Jewish family, we celebrated holidays in the home. And I think that sort of brought our children together because it was a big thing on especially Passover when we would have seders in our home. And all the cousins would come to our home, and the uncles and aunts, and that was quite a big event during the year.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand exactly, like when you say being a Jewish family, you celebrate holidays in the home, like compared to a Christian family, what?
Well, I think, it's celebrated. You practice your religion every day in your home.
Right.
On a Friday night, you light candles. It's in the home.
You say prayers.
You say,
and
blessings.
I don't know if it's a lot different. You know, Christians, they celebrate Christmas, they celebrate Easter. You know, they have their family traditions and times, but maybe we have a few more holidays to celebrate. And it was a way of bringing not only our immediate family, keeping them together, but my brothers and sisters would come with their families 2-3 times a year. And so we'd have, you know, 20 or 30 or 40 people. And in just in recent years, we started having a family reunion. And we have 52 people, all just brothers and sisters, husbands and wives, their children, their grandchildren. And so they've all gotten to know each other throughout the years. And they're not only close with the brothers and sisters, but they're close with their first cousins and now with their first cousins' children. So we really have a nice family group that keep in touch with one another. And because having a very small Jewish population in the town, and we had a small congregation and a small synagogue, and it brought not only our family but the other Jewish families all together, mm-hmm. which created an extended family. Mm-hmm. So we feel very close to a few of our non-relative families not related directly to us, but because of the close association over the years, we feel it like their family.
Yeah, I wondered if that was part of what you meant when you said that that it was inside the family, because I think if you're Christian in Eastern North Carolina and you want to celebrate or mark Christmas, of course it's a family thing, but it's also completely a part of kind of the public culture. Mm-hmm. You know, if you go downtown, or there's a Christmas parade. Mm-hmm. There's all of these things that take you out of the family as well, in a way that wouldn't be as true in a Jewish home, it seems. I wondered if that was part of what makes in some ways kind of strengthens the.
Well, I don't want to get into a discussion, the differences and the way Christmas is celebrated, because it just seems like an entirely different concept, really.
But we had a very close relationship with our Christian friends, and they would wish us a happy New Year's when the Jewish New Year's come around. We get Jewish New Year's cards, Hanukkah cards from some of our Christian friends. We were invited.
I think that happened more in later years. I don't think in the beginning there was as much of that, because as there has been in recent years, because of television and, and it's just all over the country.
The world has opened up.
It's opened up to different religions.
If it was true, where I grew up in Eastern North Carolina, you would have had no notion what the Jewish New Year was, or of, I had the strangest stereotype of Jewish people. It was one family. Mm-hmm. The Woodring sisters, three beautiful blonde hair, blue-eyed children. Mm-hmm. And when I left Carter County to come to Duke, I pretty much assumed that the Jewish people were blonde haired, blue-eyed, and very, very beautiful girls. And the girls, of course, it was true. They were beautiful. But
What was the name of that family?
Woodring.
And where they lived, where?
Well, the reason they came our way was because they were their father was a colonel in the Marine Corps.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And we lived 10 or 12 miles from Cherry Point, Marine Base. Mm-hmm. But that was my
concept.
Well, just it was ignorance. I mean, in the sense of
right.
Well, but you had been exposed.
Yeah. But the notion that we would have sent a Jewish New Year card, which was just we would never.
Well, here's the difference: our grandchildren. The two that are in school now, if they have to write a poem or write a paper, it might be on a Jewish subject. Right. But growing up, my children, I never brought that into the public school system. They didn't know anything about Jewish people. And really, when our kids were that small, were small in the 50s and 60s and so on, I think it was an entirely different story than it is now.
And in some ways, I can see it works for, like, understanding and tolerance. In other ways, it works against it, like, in my experience. Because on one hand, if you don't know something, can lead to, you know, prejudices and such. On the other hand, it can lead to, like, I don't really think it hurt me to believe that Woodring's sisters were, I was in love with all three of them. And it reminds me of like your father being invited to join the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was a case where ignorance probably didn't hurt exactly. Yeah. I mean, in some ways it meant that you were accepted in a way that, you know, in some places, obviously the Ku Klux Klan was really, you know, vehemently anti-Semitic.
That's right.
And in that sense, ignorance meant that you could actually see somebody as your brother that the outside world might have said different. I mean, I'm sure that the Klan nationally was very clear about where it stood, even if your father's friends in Weldon were not quite as clear about that.
That's a good example.
In so many, I don't know if this has anything to do with interviewing, but in so many instances, non-Jewish people have been brought up to think a certain way about Jews. I mean, it's in literature, in their church.
Especially my fundamentalist Christian neighbors back home.
Well,
very,
I mean,
you know,
not to Catholic religion. Mm-hmm. Part of the catechism, I understand, has been...
Right. Right. And
the Jews killed Christ.
Right.
And because that's been sort of explained now, but so some people still don't understand it. But anyway, our children, you know, they were good students, and they had good friends in school, even though each one was probably the only Jewish one in the class.
Right.
And they had good friends, and they didn't suffer, I don't think. One daughter was tormented. Was that the word? Very tormented by this black student who became a preacher, and but he would always yell at her, "But you Jew," things like that. A younger son told us that you know, at times he was sort of harassed a little bit, but
you know, it's strange. The two older ones said that they don't remember having any anti-Semitism, but the two younger children said that they did.
What age? Was this like a high school thing, or was this younger?
More in high school.
Yeah.
Or in the middle school, you might say.
Yeah, right.
But I think maybe, as we talked about the Weldon school system, so many of the white parents moved to Roanoke Rapids and took their children with them. Mm-hmm. So I think our older two children had a different class of friends who were in the public school, mm-hmm. and then later...
it was when the older one was in school, in high school, that integration took place, and there was a mass exodus from the public school, and a lot of the friends in Weldon went to the academy. Or they went to, what was it called? It was near Enfield.
Enfield Academy or the Halifax Academy.
Yeah.
But
kept our children in the public school, and there were very few of their friends left in public school.
Especially the younger ones didn't have
the
group
right.
to pick their friends from.
There wasn't that buffer.
That's right, as the two older ones had. So even if some of the two older children's friends went to other school, they were already friends.
Right.
Whereas
right.
the two younger ones,
it
was a different class of...
It wasn't a normal high school social setting at all.
Right.
For any of our kids.
But anyway, they didn't seem to be harmed by it. Right. They both left the school system and did well in college and in their life. after school, high school.
Mm-hmm. And last time we talked, you made clear that none of your children was really tempted to they had no notions of settling in Weldon.
They couldn't wait to leave Weldon. But in later years, they loved to come back to visit. And I think they had, even though they wanted us to move and felt like we would have a better life living in the Chapel Hill, Raleigh area, and that we would be closer to most all of them, and that, you know, for our senior years, it'd be good for us to be closer to them. I think they had a little mixed emotions when we finally said we're going to move. They wanted to come back and see the house, and they wanted to come and spend a weekend before we moved, and they wanted to ride up and down the streets of Weldon and point out where we used to live and where this one lived and that one lived, and bring back memories. But they're happy that we're in Chapel Hill,
and I think the grandkids will see you more here, and their memories will be of you here.
And we're happy that we're here. Mm-hmm.
Well, is there anything else we should? I know you can't do a child's life in 5 minutes, but is there anything else we should cover about the children's lives and your relationships with them?
Well, we sort of supported them in what they wanted to do. They all wanted to go to the University of North Carolina, and fortunately, they were all accepted. Mm-hmm. Ben, after he finished, he had a degree in education. He taught for 1 year, but before he even taught, he went to the University of Pennsylvania and got a master's degree in sort of media education, and that led to his going into public relations. Betty got a degree in
psychology
and speech, and then she got a couple of masters at Appalachian University and in adult education and reading, and she's the one who works at the community college in Greensboro. Bert got a degree, as Sarah said, in public health, but she spent a year in Israel working at a health clinic, and when she came back, she decided she wanted to become a physician's assistant, and she went to Bowman Gray at Wake Forest, and she got her degree, and she practiced medicine, clinical medicine, for about 5-6 years at Johns Hopkins, came back to Duke and worked there a short while, and then went to work with Burroughs Wellcome, the drug firm, and when they merged with Glaxo, they retained her, and so she now works with Glaxo Wellcome, and our younger son, Sam, he was interested in photography ever since he was in maybe about the fifth grade.
Really?
And Sam was quite a little dissatisfied with going to school in Weldon, and he wanted to go off. And his last 2 years, he went to this friend school up in Newtown, Pennsylvania, called the George School. Mm-hmm. And he got a wonderful education there. And he continued in his photography, and when he came to Chapel Hill, he worked for the Daily Tar Heel, and also worked with the Daily Tar Heel, and it became a photo editor for the Yakety Yak. Stayed here a year after he graduated, helping them to finish publishing the Yakety Yak. And then he went into newspaper work, but he wanted to go where there was more action. And he went up to Washington, D.C., and just on his own, he developed a nice following, and he's done work for a lot of the national magazines and papers and whatnot. So the children have all been very successful in their work, and they've all married very nice people, and we're very proud of our two daughter-in-laws and our two son-in-laws, so. That creates a nice family relationship. That we're very close to our children's spouses.
You sound proud of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You sound proud of all of them.
We are very proud of them. And,
they're good kids.
And really unfortunately, they seem very proud of their parents too. Really, it's very nice for them want to come to be with us and want to include us in their activities, and so fortunately we've had a good life.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it. Forgot where I was going from here. I got distracted by all the children. Last time I was here, you told me that it looked in your eyes it was pretty likely that the synagogue was just inevitably going to have to close sometime in the next space of years.
Few years, sure.
We went over the number of the congregants, the members, and their ages, and it did look like so many of them were getting up in age, and the younger people weren't staying. And I just wanted to ask you again a little bit about what it is that you hope might be preserved from the synagogue, and why that matters to you.
Okay, that's been a concern of most all of us. Even though we're away from Weldon, we're still a very active part of the membership. And there are only about four other families represented there, and most of them are between 70s and 80s. So we know that in a few years, there's not hardly any Jewish newcomers coming into the community who would carry it on. I think the artifacts, the things that we use in ceremonies during the services, like candlesticks, the Torahs, candelabras, I think they would probably be passed on to some other congregation. There's a group in Chapel Hill wants to form a congregation here. There's a new group in Virginia Beach where we have some close ties with people in Virginia Beach who used to live in Weldon, Ronald Crappies. They might would want some of our artifacts. But the big thing that we're concerned about is what will happen to the memorial tablets. Now, in the Jewish religion, generally, in the synagogues, you place or erect a memorial tablet with a nameplate of a person saying when they were born and when they died. And on the anniversary of that person's death, a light is lit.
24 hours.
We have electric lights on each plaque, on each nameplate, and we light that. And usually it's for 24 hours, but in the case of Weldon, since we only have services once a week, we let them burn for the whole week. And a memorial prayer is said for that person, usually by his family, but if the family is not there, it's said by the congregation. Mm-hmm. So we have probably 80 names.
Yeah, but tell him what a memorial prayer.
You say the Kaddish is a prayer praising God.
It's your reaffirmation in the belief of God. It's not. It doesn't name the person that you're remembering. It's just a reaffirmation in God.
So we have. It's either four or five memorial tablets, and each tablet holds about, I would say, 20 names. Mm-hmm. And they're all of them are not members from our congregation, but they have someone in our congregation had ties with that person. It could be a parent, a grandparent, or a friend. Mm-hmm. And so we would like those memorial tablets to be preserved, erected someplace, and on the anniversary of that person's death, the light be lit and a prayer be said in memory of that person. And we're just beginning to think how that could be worked. Now, whether we could find an established synagogue that we could turn those over to and they would maintain them, erect them on one of their walls, light the electric light we call them the candle, but actually it's an electric candle, and say a memorial prayer. Or maybe there's a new congregation forming. Like I said, there's going to be a new congregation forming and is formed, has been formed in Virginia Beach, but they don't have a synagogue yet and they want to build a synagogue. Thought in my mind, maybe if they build a new synagogue in Chapel Hill, that maybe they would be willing to take it and maybe we would turn over some of our assets to that congregation to help them get started. We have the property because we have some funds. And the thinking is now that those of us who have survived up to now should be the ones to decide what should be done with the building, the artifacts, the memorial tablets.
We have beautiful stained glass windows.
That's what I was going to say, that it would be a shame to leave them there, and then no telling what the building would be used for. And it would have no significance whatsoever to any, even if a church were to go in it, they wouldn't have the significance. Right. So at least those of us who are still around are beginning to be really concerned about the future of the synagogue, not just the building, but the things that are in the building. And there is a place in Jackson, Mississippi, the Living Museum of Judaism, and
Southern Judaism.
Yeah. But they've contacted us and said they would like to help us to preserve our artifacts and make sure they didn't end up on the flea market. And any way they could help us, and in this states around Mississippi, Louisiana, and whatnot, they're going in and preserving some of these old synagogues in small towns. Now, I don't know that they would be able to come up here and do this one because there would be nobody left there to really see that it's maintained. And so anyway, we're probably going to start exploring possibilities and come up with some general plan. We have trustees, and because I guess at the end, the trustees will decide what to do, but hopefully we'll have given them some guidelines to go by.
Is there is the way that, you would look at, I'm not quite sure I understand the religious significance of the artifacts. I mean, to the degree that they're beyond their use in services.
They live on forever, I think. The Torahs and...
I'm not as knowledgeable of the Bible as I probably should be, but in the first five books of Moses, when they describe the tabernacle, it tells that there should be candelabras on both sides of the ark. The ark should hold the word of God, and that's the Torah, is the first five books of Moses, which is the word of God. And there should be certain coverings that only the high priest should enter and see them. But of course, time has changed, and we don't have a high priest, and any person is considered just as holy as the next one, so they could see the Torahs and the scrolls and all that. But anyway, and they're beautiful. You know, most of them are made out of, they're not made out of any metal that could be used as an instrument of war. They're soft metals, so they're made with silver and some gold and brass. And so that, you know, they're valuable for what they're made out of, right, if nothing else. And because they're symbolic of the Jewish religion. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, all have a meaning. Mm-hmm. We have eternal light that burns, which is symbolic of the burning bush, and the eternity of everlasting, eternity of God, God's word. Mm-hmm. And So you know, they won't be hard to dispose of in a good way, but what might be hard to dispose of would be our stained glass windows, because they're very large, and we have maybe 10, 12 of them. And
different holidays of the Jewish religion.
And of course, they would be very expensive. They would be very expensive to replace today, because they were bought in the early 1950s.
So they depend.
The Jewish holidays, like the Jewish New Year, the Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement, the Sabbath. We have the Sukkot, which is what Thanksgiving was taken from, the Jewish holiday of Sukkot. We have Shavuos, which is it's the time of the spring first harvest. You know, in olden days, the Jewish people were more or less agrarians. They farmed, and they have the first harvest, and then in the fall, Sukkot, the last second harvest, which Thanksgiving is taken from. We have the Feast of Hanukkah, and we have the Feast of Purim, and we'll have all windows that are symbolic, and they're beautiful. You know, they're real works of art. And just like in your churches, you have beautiful stained glass windows. At least the churches in Weldon, they're old churches. They have beautiful stained glass windows. So hopefully, you know, they could be put to some good use, and not. We don't know what would happen to that building. Somebody might convert it into a home. Mm-hmm. some small church group might want to buy it.
To really start working on that now. There's nothing been done.
There's a meeting in March, Bill was telling me, and Eugene Bloom was telling me. Mm-hmm. And they're going to have a meeting in March for that main purpose.
And then the other thing that sounds like it would be hard would be the memory tablets.
Memorial tablets. Synagogue would have to be willing to take them and mount them on the wall and have the electric candles connected. And most of the synagogues, they all have their own memorial tablets. So, I mean, they would have to adopt ours. And maybe, in my thinking, maybe we would give them a certain amount of funds to maintain it. Because fortunately, our synagogue has kept a good reserve all through the years. The fact that we didn't have a lot of expense, we didn't have a rabbi to support, we didn't have to provide a lot of expense for a rabbi and whatnot.
It's been years since we had children and, you know, Sunday school.
And most all of us were willing to keep our due structure, even though it's the same due structure. Well, we just changed it this year because our funds were getting too big. So, you know, we probably have some funds that we would, my thinking, give to the congregation that would take those and adopt them. With my word.
Is there a special role of or a outlook kind of in the Jewish, I don't know what you'd call it, cosmology in the Jewish religion for the memory of the dead? The memorial tablets are part of every synagogue's life.
Well, you know, I don't know if it's specified, say, in the five books of Moses for that. But, you know, they tell of Abraham marking his wife's grave. But it's just over the centuries, I guess, these things might have started off just as a custom, but over the centuries they've become integral part of the religion.
In the Jewish religion, when a child is born, you name them after a person who has died.
Passed away.
To maintain
that memory.
For instance, if Harry, I don't know who he was named after.
My grandfather.
But anyway, he always would be, what's your Hebrew name?
Yeheskel.
Yeheskel Ben
Ben Leibel, and that was my father's.
Ben
Harry, the son of Lewis.
Right.
And A lot of folks, in they tell me in old in Europe, even, you know, that's how people were known. He was Mordecai, the son of Jacob, you know, and that's like, and they would say, you know, that's the way they wouldn't even think about a last name. But anyway, there are a lot of customs in Judaism that over the centuries have just become a vital part of the religion.
They're very ancient.
And that's why we have three main divisions in the Jewish religion. You have your Orthodox, which is almost like your evangelical folk. You know, they
believe literally what's written.
And that anything that was a custom over the period of years becomes a permanent part of it. Mm-hmm. And then there's a conservative who are a little more relaxed and a little more and willing to change.
They reinterpret some of the things.
And then the reform, you know, they...
They reinterpret it more.
They reinterpret more. And I think that the words that are found in the Bible should be interpreted according to our times today,
that's
not
right.
According to what was 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years
and
ago.
And that's one thing about the Jewish religion. It is a changing. It changes with the times, but yet some things never change. You know?
Well, it changes if you're not Orthodox, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's right.
And even in
that's
the Orthodox, right. They're extreme Orthodox.
Right.
Very extreme, I mean.
They have degrees of Orthodox.
And so, right. So anyway, I don't think we're the ones to really discuss religion.
No, well, I care about how it matters in your lives. I mean, how you interpret it for your lives, not
yeah,
how
well,
you interpret
you know,
it for
I might say
the
this.
Jewish people as a whole.
Well, it's interesting just how the religion has evolved in the little town of Weldon. Among the Jewish people, the first ones that came there were Orthodox. They kept kosher. They maintained
everything was said in Hebrew. The prayers were all said in English, in Hebrew, not in English, and all. And then I really think it was my father who sort of got them thinking that maybe we were too Orthodox, because the younger people. I'm talking about younger people. My age and even a little older than I am, when we were coming along, we didn't understand the Hebrew. And we would sit there and not know what was going on.
Right.
And so he thought we should get a rabbi who used English as well as Hebrew. And I think he was instrumental in bringing in a conservative student rabbi to help us during the holidays and whatnot. And then later, even conservative didn't seem to fit into our generation, because most of us didn't maintain the real strict customs. A conservative rabbi would not ride on the Sabbath, where we felt like we needed a rabbi who would ride on the Sabbath so he could go visit the sick.
So even a conservative rabbi wouldn't ride on the...
No, conservative rabbis, you know, they're pretty strict in their observances. But they use English. They use English and whatnot, and we didn't have anyone in the community who kept what we call kosher, and it made it the eating hard, and they wouldn't ride, so that we had to find a home close to the temple for them to sleep in and stay in when they come, and we realized that we weren't observing all those things, and that we thought that it would be better to get a reform rabbi who would stay in the motel, and he would ride to visit the sick and places. We've had a lot of later rabbis and student rabbis, and
since we started with the reform movement, most of our rabbis have been women.
Roughly what years would that have been?
Late 60s, early 70s, I guess. And so when we had children, we would get a student rabbi to come down about maybe once every 2 weeks for the weekend. And he or she would conduct services. They would teach the children. They would have an adult session at night. And they would, you know, visit the sick. Sometimes they would speak in the churches or to Christian groups. And then, because when all our children grew up and all, we start having them come once a month.
Where would they come from?
From the seminary in New York or Cincinnati, they would fly in, say, to Richmond and rent a car and drive down to Weldon and then do the same going back.
And what about things like, like bar mitzvahs or bat mitzvahs?
Well, these,
did y'all still go off for that? Or
well,
did
no,
that
we
start
were,
happening in Weldon?
That started happening in Weldon. They would train students, because they would go through what we call Sunday school or Hebrew school, and they would get their basic foundation for being bar mitzvah, and we would have the ceremony.
And y'all provided your Sunday school provided the religious education.
That's right.
For that.
We, you know, when our children were coming along, Sarah and I and several of the others.
Did we mention the circuit riding rabbi project?
Yes.
Because that's a big part of this North Carolina.
Well, that's actually what I wondered was, does that mean that we're all, was the circuit rabbis always reformed? Or
no, they were Orthodox at first.
So they would come
the
in.
The beginning.
They would come in before
the Sabbath, yeah.
And stay over.
This was before we started
affiliating.
Then,
well, I wondered how that worked.
Yeah, most.
They weren't showing up the day of services.
They were staying the whole weekend there.
Yeah.
And they could only cover one.
People would have to come to them.
They could only cover one town.
The headquarters being Weldon, so the people from Emporia and the people from Roanoke Rapids and all would come to Weldon. But, you know, we realized as time went on that, you know, especially those who couldn't travel, they needed the rabbi as much as anybody else, especially the sick and the elderly. So I guess all religions change as an evolution. Even Christianity, in most cases, it's not like it was 300 years ago, 200 years ago.
I don't know. Catholicism, I think, might be.
Well, that's changing a lot now.
Yeah.
You know, everything used to be in Latin, and things are just even different. The Pope issues new decrees that they never would have issued 200 years ago.
I think the. I can call it this because my father was Catholic, but the tyranny of the Catholic Church imposes a certain kind of order you're not even allowed in some ways to name different branches of Catholicism, even though they exist in the same way that you could call a branch of Catholicism Orthodox and conservative and Reformed and probably other things as well. But you don't, because unless it's sanctioned.
Some of our American bishops
are completely different. One bishop calls Catholicism and another is almost unrecognizable.
I don't know if I told you this in our early conversations, but my best friends growing up in Weldon were Catholics. And did I speak of that?
No.
And after
Catholics there either.
Oh yeah, there were just a few, and these were Lebanese actually. Who came and settled, sort of like the Jewish people did.
You
they opened
the Lebanese,
a little.
Grocery?
It was a grocery and clothing store and whatnot. And I used to go to their home and play after school, and the priest would come to their home to teach them the catechism. And I would sit in the corner and listen. And I remember the oldest sister said I was learning it better than her younger brothers and sisters are learning it. But we had a good relationship with them.
Well, it was a very different experience, but it must have been similar to some degrees, because I assume there was no Catholic church.
There was a Catholic church in Roanoke Rapids at that time, and there was a very old Catholic church
in
Halifax that predated the one in Roanoke Rapids. And it's a very historic place now, the old Catholic church. And
I don't think it's
used. It must have been some kind of mission church originally.
And I don't know if they ever had a priest there or not. But, you know, I've known the priest in Roanoke Rapids, you know, throughout the years, all of them I've known. So anyway, I think that covers it. Religion is pretty good. Now you were asking about the Holocaust.
I was. I was curious about the extent, if at all, that the awareness of the Holocaust or the existence of the Holocaust was felt by your family or by the Weldon Jewish community?
Well,
this was before I came to Weldon.
Okay, so I'll tell my story, and then if Sarah has anything to add. But my father came from Poland, and he left his parents in Poland, a sister, some nieces and nephews. My dad came over, you know, in 1912.
Right.
And he and my mother would write to them, and they would send packages of clothing. It had to be used clothing. I remember putting on shoes and going out in the backyard and marring the soles to make them look like they were used shoes, rubbing them in the dirt and stuff like that. But anyway, my dad and mother kept in touch with the family in Poland. Mm-hmm. And then when the war came, all of a sudden, we didn't hear any more from them. And then in about 1944, my dad got a telegram from the Red Cross saying that they had word that his parents had died. We didn't know how or why or what happened to any of the other people. About 1964, my dad got a letter from a niece who was in Russia. And the letter was written in Russian.
She was from Russia? She lived in Russia?
Well, at that time, she was in Russia. Uh-huh. It was the first that he had heard from any of his... We just assumed, and he assumed, that everybody had been wiped out in the Holocaust. She wrote